Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Arun Gupta, who discusses New York City's decision to dismantle the original Occupy Wall Street encampment in Zuccotti Park and the response of the Occupy movement confronting similar tactics nationwide. Clay Atawan of the prisoners' rights group Adamir, who talks about the large number of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel and the violation of their rights the group says they've documented. And Susan Casey Lefkowitz of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who assesses the Obama administration's delay in making a decision on approval of the proposed Trans-Canada Keystone XL oil pipeline. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti is seeking hundreds of millions of dollars in damages from the United Nations on behalf of Haitians who suffered from the 2010 cholera outbreak. The human rights group blames the introduction of cholera in Haiti on UN peacekeepers from Nepal. They say the disease spread because of poor sanitation practices by the UN peacekeepers, which contaminated Haiti's largest river, the Arde Bonite. Since the first cholera case was identified in October 2010, over 6,500 Haitians have died and 475,000 have contracted the illness. The UN declined to comment on the petition. In September, the UN's Assistant Secretary for Field Support, Anthony Banbury, told ABC News there was not direct or conclusive proof that UN peacekeepers ignited the deadly cholera outbreak. The UN denial of responsibility has been challenged by epidemiologist Renaud Pierroux, who insisted that there is a direct connection in time and place between the arrival of the Nepalese battalion from the area experiencing the cholera outbreak and the appearance of the first case in Haiti a few days later. Doctors Without Borders estimates it would cost $40 million to vaccinate all Haitians against cholera. However, the medical aid agency claims the money would be better spent developing new water and sanitation infrastructures, which is the most effective way to stop the spread of cholera. Several Republican Party presidential candidates, including Herman Cain and Rick Perry, have proposed various forms of a new flat tax to simplify the tax code and reduce tax rates. Critics largely blast the flat tax, including Herman Cain's 999 plan, as unfair to the middle class by dramatically reducing taxes for the wealthy. Moreover, it would likely end progressive tax policies, such as the earned income tax credit received by the working poor. The United States briefly had a 3% flat tax between 1861 and 1872, but it was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Since World War I, the United States has relied on a progressive income tax to raise government revenues. According to ProPublica, the flat tax has been instituted in formerly communist nations of the former Soviet Union, which have transitioned to capitalism. The nonpartisan Tax Policy Center's analysis of the candidates' proposed GOP flat tax plans found that if implemented, they would increase government deficits, since many of them exempt investment income, like capital gains, from federal taxation. According to the Tax Policy Center, Rick Perry's flat tax plan would cut future government revenues 27% by 2015. Arizona's right-wing anti-immigrant agitator, State Senate President Russell Pierce, was recalled in a special election in his suburban Phoenix district, losing to moderate Republican Jerry Lewis, who waged a gutsy grassroots campaign. Pierce, a former deputy sheriff, is the chief architect of Arizona's SB 1070, the tough anti-immigrant law which made him a hero among many Tea Party activists. This year, Pierce pushed for more repressive legislation, including requiring health workers and school officials to enforce immigration laws. Arizona's powerful business community eventually rebelled and recruited a number of Republican legislators to oppose Pierce's right-wing agenda. In the spring, Citizens for a Better Arizona gathered 17,000 signatures to force a recall vote. Then Jerry Lewis, a Mormon and moderate Republican, stepped up to challenge Pierce. Immigration and ethics were key issues in ousting Pierce, along with a mobilized Latino community. The Senate president also suffered from an ethics scandal in accepting over $40,000 in gifts, including free trips, hotel rooms, and game tickets from the Fiesta Bowl. During a candidate's debate before the election, Lewis, a charter school executive, blamed Pierce and his anti-immigrant agenda for creating a poor business climate, declaring, "We are seen as akin to 1964 Alabama." people do not want to move their business here. Lewis refused to take PAC money during the campaign, while Pierce received large contributions from conservative special interest groups. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Just 2 days short of their two-month anniversary, New York City police swept into Lower Manhattan's Zuccotti Park, the original site of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement, and evicted activists, arrested 200 people committing nonviolent civil disobedience, and carted their tents and property away. A member of the city council and journalists were arrested during the raid. New York City's Mayor Michael Bloomberg justified the eviction, saying that health and safety conditions had become intolerable in the park, a statement disputed by Occupy activists. Bloomberg told protesters they could return to the park, but without tents or tarps, an order upheld by a New York State Supreme Court judge. The unannounced New York City police raid in the early morning hours of November 15th came as similar suppression tactics were used against Occupy protest encampments in other cities across the U.S. Evictions carried out by police had earlier targeted protesters on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley and in Oakland, California. With the initial rapid expansion of the Occupy movement, established to protest corporate greed, growing income inequality, and political corruption, followed now by government action to suppress the encampments, activists are now confronted with important decisions on how best to disseminate their message, gain wider public support, and affect policy. Your reporter spoke with journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper and a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, published by activists in Zuccotti Park. Here, Gupta discusses New York City's decision to dismantle the original Occupy Wall Street encampment and the tactical and strategic choices that must now be made by the Occupy movement.
It's violent, it's excessive, it's hypocritical, and it's to be expected. This is the revenge of the 1%. They have been trying to attack this movement since the beginning in New York City. There was a series of mass arrests and attacks on September 24th and October 1st. Then about a month ago, we saw that whole spectacle of Bloomberg claiming everyone had to leave so they could clean the park. And then he ended up backing down when there was an enormous outcry. We've seen in many other cities attacks saying that, oh, there's violence, you know, in cities like Oakland, an extremely violent city. We see hypocritical appeals to the First Amendment, that somehow people in public spaces exercising their democratic speech, having more democracy, is denying others any democracy when there was virtually none to begin with. So they want to shut it down, the 1%, because it is basically made the extreme concentration of power and wealth the number one political issue. And that means if this continues to be an issue, they will have to give up some of their power and wealth, or it will be taken from them.
Arun, do you see this police action in New York City and the other similar suppression tactics around the country as being a handicap to this movement or actually energizing it? Because we've seen outpouring of support after police action similar to this in the past in Oakland, as well as New York City and many other places around the country.
Well, it depends. You know, it's based on how each individual movement responds to it. So far in New York, it was those two police attacks on September 24th, which produced that infamous viral video of police pepper spraying women who were just standing on a sidewalk. And then a week later, over 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Those two incidents really built the movement. It brought it to national and international attention. Of course, what happened in Oakland also with the very violent police response, that sparked the general strike in that city. But in a lot of smaller cities that I've visited or been to, you know, it has not shut down the movement, but it's created difficulties. every successful social movement is going to be repressed, because what they're doing is exposing the corruption of the dominant order. So the dominant order is going to counterattack. So the question is, how do they respond by trying to circumvent and overcome this repression?
Arun, how important is occupying public space to the growth of this movement? Is it symbolic only, or is it of critical importance to keep the movement growing and expanding its reach?
Occupying space is what created this movement. There wasn't this movement before the occupations began. What there was were a lot of great people doing important work out there, a lot of organizations. There was massive discontent and despair, and what the Occupy movement shaped it, it turned that despair into hope, and it created this movement of the 99%. There was no discussion beforehand of the 99%. So having these physical occupations allowed people to come there and engage in real democratic decision-making, participatory democracy. And so many people who I've talked to at all these occupations I've visited said for the first time in their life, they felt their voice mattered. It was like an epiphany to find so many other people who were dealing with the same issues they were dealing with, lack of health care, not enough employment, about to lose their home, you know, onerous student debt. And they felt isolated, and what this did was really bring all these people together in a way that created the community that made them feel that they were creating the new society. Now, that's what it did up to this point. Going forward, I think these public spaces are important because we don't have any sort of democratic, public democratic forum in this country. That's why it became a social virus that spread and mutated so rapidly. But the movement needs to think about how it's going to respond, and part of that can be different types of occupations. We're seeing an Occupy the Universities and Campus movement. Occupations of workplaces are important. Occupations where goods are being shipped or transported are important. On Thursday, November 17th, there's a planned occupation of Wall Street in terms of protesters are going to try to peacefully, nonviolently shut down the New York Stock Exchange itself through mass of numbers. And so that's a different form of occupation. So, yes, the public spaces are important, but the public spaces are not everything.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org. In mid-October, Israel and Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Party that controls Gaza, agreed to a prisoner swap. 1,027 Palestinian political prisoners were traded for the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who has been held by Hamas since June 2006. Many Israelis were horrified by the release of Palestinians, some of whom had been convicted for violent crimes against Israelis, and some Palestinians were angry that many of the prisoners released were sent into exile. On a just-concluded trip to Israel and Palestine, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended a talk by Clea Towan, the international advocacy officer, with Adamir, a Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. She discusses the large number of Palestinians who've been arrested under the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all but 0.3% of whom have been convicted, and the growing crackdown on the rights of those prisoners held inside Israel in violation of international law, the group says they've documented.
Since 1967, more than 700,000 Palestinians have been arrested by the Israeli authorities. That number represents about 20% of the total population, of the total Palestinian population. And when you consider that most of the people who are being arrested are men, it actually represents about 40% of the male Palestinian population. And there are kind of five broad categories of offenses. The first one is named by Israel hostile terrorist activities. So that's anything to do with military activities, but it means any activity that's carried out in the context of membership of what Israel calls an illegal organization. So if you, for example, write a political slogan on the wall, or you serve coffee to somebody who is associated with an organization that's considered illegal by Israel, you can be arrested under this category of hostile terrorist activities. And you have to remember that all the political parties in Palestine are considered illegal. So Israel's official peace partners are also considered illegal. So it's really a means to arrest pretty much anyone you want, and you can use the law to arrest whoever you want to. The second category of offenses is something that's called disruptions of a public order, and that covers a wide range of civic activities. So any activities, civic activities like organizing a demonstration or taking part in a demonstration of more than 10 people, writing slogans on the wall, any distributing the Palestinian flag, all of these activities are considered illegal by Israel, and they can be penalized with up to 10 years in prison. And these, all of these offenses are categorized as disruptions of a public order. So you have these hostile terrorist activities and the disruptions of a public order, and those are the two categories that Adamir works on. Then you have three other categories that relate to criminal prisoners, and there it's Palestinians being arrested in areas B and C of the West Bank for either classic criminal offenses like theft or murder or anything like that, or traffic violations. You can actually be arrested by Israel for violating traffic laws in the occupied West Bank. And then finally, you have illegal entry into Israel. So that's usually Palestinians entering Israel to try to find work. And the majority of the criminal prisoners are actually Palestinians who are just trying to find work in Israel and cross into Israel illegally. Now, these Palestinians who are arrested for these offenses are held in approximately 17 prisons, all of which, except for one, are located inside Israel and not in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to international humanitarian law, a protected person who's arrested by the occupying power should be held inside the occupied territory, not outside of it. And transferring the population is illegal. So the very establishment of these prisons inside of Israel is illegal. But in addition to that, it also means that visits by families and by lawyers are very difficult, because families have to obtain permission to enter Israel from the Israeli authorities. Very often they're denied. Only immediate family members are allowed to go and visit, so parents, brothers, sisters, children. Nobody else from an extended family is allowed to visit. If you're a Palestinian lawyer from the West Bank, you are in fact not allowed to visit your client inside a prison in Israel. So these lawyers will only be allowed to see their clients during the trials which take place in military tribunals that are located in the OPT. So it has, not only is it illegal, but it has consequences on not only family visits, but also the right to an effective defense. There has been a kind of steady worsening of the detention conditions in that sense in the past few years. In the early phases of the occupation, detention was seen as a time as well where you could be educated, you could become more politically involved because the prison life was much more organized. In recent years, more and more prisoners are being denied education. And in fact, just when the deal was announced, there was a hunger strike by a large number of prisoners who were protesting a number of measures that had been taken after a speech by Prime Minister Netanyahu on the 23rd of June. And those measures related to education, they related to family visits. And essentially what Netanyahu said is that because Gilad Shalit was still being incarcerated, Palestinian prisoners should be punished. They should not have these generous, he called them overly generous, detention conditions. And until the release of Gilad Shalit, all their privileges should be withdrawn. So what happened after that speech is that all access to education was banned. Prisoners were cuffed to and from family visits. In some cases, family visits were reduced from 45 minutes to 30 minutes. They had no access to newspapers, to books, and other educational materials. They had limited access to TV, and a number of other measures were taken by the Israeli prison service. So the prisoners went on a hunger strike on the 27th of September to protest all these measures. And then obviously the prisoner exchange deal was announced in the middle of a hunger strike, in their third week of hunger strike. But up until now, we still don't know if those conditions will be reversed. So although they were all linked specifically to the detention of Gilad Shalit, and Gilad Shalit is now free, there still hasn't been an official announcement by the Israeli Prison Service that those measures would be withdrawn.
That was Clea Towan, the international advocacy officer with a prisoners' rights group at Amir. Find more information on the work of at Amir on our website at btlonline.org. Under pressure from an effective grassroots campaign opposing government approval of the proposed 1,700-mile-long Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline that would bring oil from Alberta, Canada's tar sands operations to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries in Texas, the Obama administration announced a 12- to 18-month delay in making a decision on the pipeline to allow further study of the project's environmental impact. The November 10th White House announcement followed a concerted effort by a large coalition of environmental groups to derail the project that included acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, resulting in over 1,200 arrests in September. Among the concerns of the U.S. and Canadian environmental groups organizing under the banner of Tar Sands Action was the greenhouse gas emissions of tar sands crude oil, which they maintain are 40% higher than conventional oil and threaten to accelerate global warming. There is also fear that oil spills from the pipeline as it crosses Nebraska's Sand Hills region could pollute an important underground aquifer there that supplies water to several states for farm irrigation and drinking water. While pipeline opponents applauded the Obama administration's delay of a decision until after the 2012 presidential election, TransCanada said they would propose a new route that avoided the Sand Hills aquifer and were confident of eventual approval. Your reporter spoke with Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's international program, part of the Tar Sands Action Coalition. She assesses oil industry pressure on the White House to approve the pipeline and how the delay could affect the government's final decision.
Tar sands oils is basically this very dirty form of oil that has much higher greenhouse gas emissions. But it's also symbolic of a type of oil that oil companies are going after more and more now that is more difficult to extract. And if we start going sort of to the ends of the earth to get this much dirtier form of oil, we're really not going to be able to fight climate change the way that we need to. And with people all over the United States raising concerns about this pipeline, the president made the right choice. And he said, you know, let's give this a fresh environmental review. Let's take all of these concerns of people from across America into account. And take another hard look at whether this pipeline and this tar sands oil is in the national interest.
I've read recently that the TransCanada Pipeline Company is actually saying that it will reroute around a sensitive underground aquifer area in Nebraska, which was one of the reasons that there was some concern about the environmental impact. And the company says they're quite sure that if they do reroute, that the Obama administration will approve the project down the line, and it seems like this decision is being kicked down the road until after the presidential election.
Basically, the route of the pipeline, whether or not it goes through the Nebraska Sand Hills and the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the main source of fresh water for eight states in America's heartland, was one of the really critical issues at hand in the discussion and the concerns raised about this pipeline. But the other big area of concern is that of climate change. Climate change is real. Americans are feeling it every day in their lives now, seeing it in droughts and violent storms and unprecedented floods. And so what's important is that the Obama administration has made a commitment not just to look at alternative routes to the pipeline, but also to take another hard look at the environmental concerns, including climate change, in making a decision about whether this pipeline is in the nation's best interest or not.
Susan, How much pressure is there from the big oil companies and certain unions that are looking for the creation of thousands of jobs with this pipeline project? How much pressure is on the White House to, in the end, decide in favor of this pipeline?
Well, you know, I think that one reason why President Obama's decision to give a fresh environmental review to this pipeline was so courageous is that the pressure from big oil is enormous. Every major oil company in the world is sort of going after tar sands oil with this gold rush mentality. They don't really care what happens to the environment. What they care about is their bottom line and their profits. And you can see that in the type of destruction that extraction of tar sands brings. It basically, you're strip mining boreal forests and wetlands. You're fragmenting a wilderness that is, you know, a nesting site for migratory birds in order to both dig and sometimes heat and steam this very raw bitumen, it's called. It's kind of this raw tarry substance out of the earth so that eventually it can be turned into gasoline. And so what it really comes down to is enormous pressures on the president and on the State Department, I think, to move forward with the approval process. And that's exactly what they've taken a stand against doing because they heard the concerns of the American people and they want to try to get this decision right.
This XL pipeline project is symbolic of a much larger issue, and that is moving away industrial societies across the planet from fossil fuels, which produce global warming, toward a more serious focus in funding for green and renewable energy sources. That's the objective, I'm sure, the long-range objective of your campaign. Do you have any hope that progress is being made on that front?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of progress being made in terms of building clean energy alternatives, especially for moving around, you know, for in terms of smart growth and public transit, in terms of getting renewable energy into the grid so that we can be using it to fuel our cars and our vehicles instead of depending so much on oil. But what's also really important, I've always found, as you push for the clean energy alternatives, is to be fighting the dirty energy. Because otherwise, you end up with oil companies who are working hard to undermine those clean energy options, which essentially are their competition.
That was Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program. Find links to more information on the Keystone XL pipeline debate on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.